Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here with Russ Chinelli and another special guest who's a chemist, which is unusual because we don't have too many chemists. And this is a chemist that's actually not in a laboratory, but sitting at a computer terminal. He calculates structures. He calculates reactivities. And it's probably one of the new waves in science, but we're not there yet where we can do without experimentalists like myself and Russ. But Russ, who's our guest today?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Dieter Kramer from SMU Chemistry Department. Dieter, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to see you again. I think you were here about 25 years ago, and you haven't changed a bit, and neither have I, I'm sure. But we're going to have a little chat about Dieter Kramer. But before we get into this calculation business and theoretical science as opposed to experimental, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you become a scientist?
Well, I guess I have to say that I'm not the normal chemist who got in contact with chemistry in his high school years and from then on was always in chemistry. It was, in my way, totally a different way because I wanted to go into literature. I studied the Russian literature, the Russian intelligentsia, and it was quite clear what I was to become. But then my father had a company, he got sick, and I had to take over the company of my father. They had an import agency, so all of a sudden I was a businessman. And I tried to do business on the one hand side and to do literature on the other hand side, but it didn't work out. Because if you are among 2,000 students, it's difficult to be supported by your professors. They'd hardly notice you. So after a couple of years, I met a former schoolmate, and he told me, well, I'm in chemistry, and it's very easy to get a grant there. So go to chemistry. There are just 50 people, and you get ahead of them easily. I started chemistry not because I wanted to become a chemist, just to make some money.
Just to get a grant.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, where were you a businessman?
We had an import agency. We imported coffee, tea. Later on, it was petroleum oil from all countries. And my father,
from where?
Especially Middle America, my father thought that I should work on a plantage in Costa Rica, San Jose. That was my future.
And I would say my father and my grandfather did exactly the same thing, and we have a very similar story.
Okay. So history repeats itself. Anyhow, I started in chemistry, and I got my grant. I became a fellow of the famous Studienstiftung des Deutschen Volkes, and they gave you the money, which I liked very much. I could go then also to my literature classes and learn about Kafka, but they also gave you an advisor, and this advisor was a chemist professor who looked very careful how I proceeded in chemistry. So I made my so-called Ford diploma, that is the first stage in your chemistry career. And he told me then, oh, you should speed up and see that you make also your diploma. I thought, oh, that's not bad. I make a diploma and then go into literature. When I made my diploma, the next stage was, you make a PhD now. You don't go to literature. So I wound it up in chemistry and did organic synthesis. I worked with a famous professor, Professor Emanuel Vogel, who made these bridged annulenes. So you started with some kilogram, and after 12 steps, you had the milligram of a bridged annulene. And you gave this milligram then to an NMR spectroscopist, and he measured the spectrum, and he got all the answers. He was on top of the publication, and I, who had done all the work, was the last one in the publication.
Of course. There's a friend of Russ and mine. His name is Hal Murray, and he used to work for Exxon, probably still does. But he wrote an article in a journal called the Journal of Irreproducible Results.
Yeah.
And the thrust was, when you see this list of authors, you know, you've got to have some way of designating who does what. So the person with the idea, there should be a light bulb flashing, right? The one who wrote the grant, you know, should have a dollar sign or a Deutschmark sign or a euro sign. Yeah. And then the poor sod that does the work, right, has a shovel. And look, this is it. We need more demarcation.
I didn't wait for such a solution. My solution was, I better move to NMR spectroscopy. So I joined Harald Günther, who at that time was a famous NMR spectroscopist, and did then all the measurements. You know, I spent days for getting the carbon-13 right. You did this with a cut with an accumulating device, and every time a train passed by, my spectrum was gone. So I did this then, and actually I made my PhD in NMR spectroscopy. When the spectrums were finished, analyzed, the data went to Heilbronner in Basel, and he did then the MO calculations. And again, I had somebody in front of me. And I said, you know, that I don't stand any longer. I moved to theory to
this
get
is,
on
this
top
is
of
great.
The reason.
Constantly moving to get your name at the head of the paper. And now I'm sure your name is usually the last one because
it's
of,
the last
you've
one.
Reached the vaulted state of yeah. Professor Emeritus.
But being the last one is really attractive because one of my Chinese students said in China, you look only for the last name.
Wonderful. That's actually a very illuminating
it
little
is,
story.
It is, but let me ask you, along the way, since you were in business, yeah. didn't you ask why this aniline molecule or whatever you were working on was useful or useless? Or?
The practical aspect meant always something to me, and there was my understanding of the consequences on the one hand side and my drive into theory on the other hand side. So in theory, I made the same movement. I realized that real theory were only done by mathematicians. I joined John Popel, the later Nobel laureate, at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And there I had a mathematician who told me, you know, just doing theory is not enough. You must become a mathematician. And I became a little bit of a mathematician. And he developed the method, and I learned a lot with him doing my own method development. So if we look back, there are now 40, 50 years of quantum chemical calculations. It all started in the early 70s, and I was postdoc with Popel from 72 to 74. That was just the height of the perturbation expansion calculations, where you, for the first time, got an easy way to describe the correlated movement of the electrons, which the people before who used just Hartree-Fock couldn't do. So I got this knowledge with me, and I thought about going back to experiment. No. I thought about going to literature. Yes, maybe. But then I stayed, of course, in the calculations because it's a nice working place. You are not in danger of anything. And I started my own research.
Did you
group.
Ever run into a guy named John Newsom who started molecular simulations?
No.
Molecular simulations, which has become Accelerus, yeah. and he was yeah. the founder of Accelerus. Accelerus, yeah. for the audience, is a company that makes sort of canned software like yeah. Sirius 2, Material Studios, and so on. Yeah. And from a person that loves theory and application, the word is innovation is accelerated. The pace of research yeah. is easier when you use these programs.
Yeah. Having this background in business, even though I may not should say this, people like me who are in research stay away from Accelerus because it's awfully expensive.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yep.
So tell us then, you've got this now expertise. You've moved through the ranks. You've gone from the back of the paper to the middle of the paper to the top of the paper and back to the back. Right. How do you choose the problems that you tackle? I mean, there's just an inordinate number of possible targets for using your theoretical chemistry. How do you choose what ones you do? Is this a matter of your own personal taste, or people come to you and you choose what to do that way?
No, there it depends on my background. I'm still an organic chemist, and I was exposed to the problems of that time. That was, how do we understand pi delocalization? What does it mean in porphyrins? So my choice, my approach to theory was always choose a particular problem, a chemical problem, and see how you can solve this in the best way. And we did always a method development to solve a practical problem. So we later moved into the ozonolysis problematic and how this affects atmospheric chemistry. And we realized then quickly that all the methods we had available to describe this problem were not sufficient.
You're talking about the methodology, the yeah. mechanism of how ozone, which is an oxygen analog, I mean, it's O3, yeah. how it interacts with aromatic systems or olefinic systems.
That would be, for example, when you talk about cancer epoxidation okay. mechanism. But in general, ozonolysis is twofold important. Number one, as a means to generate certain compounds in organic chemistry. Number two, because in atmospheric chemistry, we have a large amount of ozone which reacts with the exhaust from industry. And what takes place there is ozonolysis. So it is interesting that for decades, one didn't know what really happens in this reaction. There was a German professor, Kriege, who had suggested the mechanism in the beginning, but it was never verified because the intermediates were too short-lived, carbonyl oxides and dioxirates. So for some time, it was our task to identify these intermediates and to see their reactions and see what comes out. The identification required special, highly accurate methods, and those we developed. So the development of new methods, in this case, we went into the perturbation theory. We did fifth-order and sixth-order perturbation theory, saw that still was limited, even though it was an enormous amount of programming and putting in computational power was not sufficient. We had to go to coupled cluster theory, and then we solved it. And it turned out that we could connect then to the experimentalists. There are the people in matrix isolation spectroscopy who try to generate.
So you're calculating the spectra for these reaction products.
The infrared spectrum.
Yeah, the infrared spectrum, which in my experience is one of the more difficult ones to calculate compared to others.
You are correct. You must be very precise. And you have to think, is it really so that in the matrix nothing interacts, that these are isolated species? So, but when you do this, then in connection with the experimentalists, and that is always what we try to do, this interdisciplinary work, really that matters, in connection with the experimentalists then to identify such a species. And we were then the first, together with Wolfram Sander, at the University in Bochum, Germany, to identify.
So basically somebody measures the infrared of an unknown, and you can simulate the spectrum and say, this is what it is, and here are the different stretching frequencies, et cetera, et cetera.
That is exactly the way it works.
And one of the things in reading the papers there, I see that a lot of the assignments are plus or minus 10 reciprocal centimeters. How accurate really is it?
Yeah, what we do in these cases, we make an harmonic approach. That was in the 80s when we did these kind of studies. But you have not just a single line, you have a sequence, you have a pattern of lines. And this pattern of lines tells you already enough to identify positively a compound.
So a single frequency is really not very useful.
Would not be very useful. Of course, a single frequency, which was most interesting, that was the OO stretching frequency, which was unusual in the carbonyl oxide because you had partial double bond character. And so even that could have helped you to identify and to distinguish between the cyclic compound, the dioxirane, and the carbonyl oxide. So we identified these compounds, got then interested because at that time drug design made its first steps into computations and people had checked the Bergman cyclization. We all know what the Bergman cyclization is. I had to learn.
Well, actually, most of our audience don't. Oh, no. And Russ and I wouldn't want to take an exam this morning. So.
So you take an diene. You have a double bond and two flanking groups all with a triple bond. So a six-membered system, and that can electrocycle, it's Woodford-Hoffmann symmetry allowed, to the benzene ring. But that is not the normal benzene ring. Two hydrogens are missing. And you get, instead of a benzene, a dihydrobenzene, the para-benzine with a Y. And these compounds we heard about in our Vogel classes, and I thought, well, they're so unstable, why do we learn about these? Nature has a different idea about these things. Nature can generate these compounds by building a big insulating block around it, and by this block forcing this electrocyclic reaction to take place, and then you get, in the midst of a natural compound, a bioradical. Now, bioradicals have the advantage they are not so aggressive like radicals. They're more sensitive. And what they can do, for example, they abstract hydrogen atoms from DNA. So you find there what has been developed already billions of years ago in microorganism. Microorganism protects themselves against bacteria and viruses by having these naturally occurring indenes and destroying the DNA of the bacteria and the viruses. So when one learns from nature, one sees that a reaction which was considered in the organic chemistry laboratory and in the courses has a reality in life, and you can use this, if you understand the mechanism, to make a drug out of it.
Well, that's very interesting, Dieter, and we'll come back to that in the second half. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Russ Kinelli, Dieter Kramer from Southern Methodist University. We'll be back in one moment. Well, we're back with Dieter Kramer, Keith Pannell, and Russ Kinelli. So when we left, you were just talking about these bioradicals that some of these bacteria have, and then you got on to drug design. Have you, in your own research, been intimately involved in designing of any drugs?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, these naturally occurring indenes have been found to be potential drugs, anti-cancer drugs, and they are used in Japan. But the Japanese obviously have not so strict drug regulations as we have them here in the United States, because these naturally occurring indenes are also toxic. They don't distinguish between a tumor cell and a normal cell.
Now, I think you've made an interesting point there that I have to comment on, and that is that because of the restrictions here in the United States, we are falling behind in these areas. It's too hard to get a new drug here as opposed to Japan or China or Europe.
I see it a little bit different. Let me say, in Europe, sometimes the restrictions are even tougher. But when you have such a restriction, you have to try to make the best out of it. So our chemical input there is, you know, how can we change the drug in such a way that it is no longer toxic? So you have this indene which cycles. And now how can you prevent the cycling in a normal cell? And how could it take place in a cancer cell? And there you start then to think, what is different in a cancer cell? You have more oxygen use, the cell needs more nutrition, and in particular, it becomes slightly acidic. Now you can exploit this. You bring in a door handle, so to say, in the drug head, in the biologically active part, and this door handle is an amidine. This amidine is sensitive to protonation. So we made it the way that the amidine can trigger the indene cyclization leading to the bioradical and then the DNA killer in the way that only this takes place when you protonate it. This sounds simple, but is in reality very difficult.
Well, then, the drug company, you walk in with that, and the other person walks in and says, here's this chemical from this plant growing in the Amazon that the natives eat. And they say, you go away, you're too expensive. We're going to try that one.
That is the point. You have to work on it. You have to do it in a way that the drug can be synthesized, can be easily made, and that it is effective. For example, I explain the principle, but how really does it work? Because you have to know that the pH difference in the cell, normal and tumor cell, is just half unit, you know, and there the amidine gives you the chance to fine-tune it to this half a unit difference, and that we have solved, you know, that is published.
Well, let's just go back a moment. I just want to remind the audience here that Russ has always been a great proponent of less restrictions on drug design and use. But then coming from Europe,
it's called innovation.
But there can also
it
be
makes the
disaster.
Economy go and not bankrupt by people stopping advances.
However, you think back to reality and you think of thalidomide, you think of organotin materials, you think of iridium for children with rheumatoid arthritis. And these were disastrous experiments in Europe because there was no regulation. You've got to err on the side of regulation.
You know what the error is? It's if there's a negative in the U.S., 1 in 1,000,000 negative tests, okay? Now, if you have a terminal disease, as I tell you, I have a cure, but every million person dies from this, are you going to try it? This is another show, folks.
So Now, you're interested in organic chemistry, but I notice that, I mean, from my interests, I'm a metal chemist, and I know you do some really interesting work on metals, mercury, for example. Is that more difficult? And tell us about why you're doing that.
Well, we have to realize that chemists have to change with their research topics. They have to adjust to the needs of the time, and nowadays it's the sustainability of this world, which all drives us. So there are so many problems which have to be solved, and some of the means we have nowadays are material science, catalysis, nanotechnology, and I got more and more engaged in this area. So we are interested in quantum dots. Now you have
quantum dots. What is a quantum dot?
We all know that an atom has no longer continuous energy states but has quantized energy states. If you have bulk matter in general, you have also continuous states. However, if you confine the space of your bulk matter, that means you make it smaller and smaller. In the nano range, you experience all of a sudden a quantization as in the atom. One has talked about pseudo-atoms in this connection. This quantization has a beautiful effect because these tiny particles send off light if emitted. And this light wavelength depends on the size of the small particle. So you can vary by varying the radius of such a particle.
It's interesting for the for the audience, you know, that extended solid has these properties. When you make it small enough, it's on the borderline between a macromolecule and a solid and has different properties.
Correctly. And that is what we have learned in the last 10, 20 years. And you use these quantum dots now for all purposes, biosensing, in material science and so on. There are quantum dots made out of so-called group 2B, cadmium, zinc, mercury, chalcogenides. And one has done this with cadmium and with zinc. One hasn't done very much with mercury. And the idea came up when you do it with mercury, you get a very special biosensor which emits light after excitation in the red and far infrared. For what can you use this? You can use this for bioimaging. Normally, the light which comes from a cell, you know, suppose you have a quantum dot in a drug and that has entered the cell, is absorbed by the layers of tissue. This infrared light will penetrate several layers of tissue, and therefore such a quantum dot would give you a chance to observe what is going on in the cell. So therefore one has this interest in mercury quantum dots, but one knows mercury is poisonous. One has to balance this.
I wondered when you were going to get to that point.
and there something like what you say comes up. So the alternative is that you don't jump for the experiments right away. You do the calculations and you find out whether this material is really that useful and whether one can protect oneself in some way. And that is the essence of our research.
So you're moving more into biological chemistry and health-related issues.
As a theoretician, your first task is to work together with colleagues in experiment. And your colleagues in experiment really will never learn all your theory. On the contrary, you have to learn what they are doing. And this is a wonderful training for a scientist. You
but
know?
Let me ask you this question, though, because I want to go back to the theory, though, a little bit for the audience. Okay, you have an atom, and now it's in a molecule. And there's all these bonds. The bonds are like little springs. So you use this force field thing, which is empirical, and you can say something about the springs, but now you have to put the electrons in. And then later on, when you go from molecules to solids, you have to use an extended theory like this DFT, density functional theory that we use now. Could you talk a little bit about how the theory advanced in terms of electrons, extended solids, molecules, etc.?
So in general, if you want to have accurate result, you have to start with quantum chemistry. You have to solve the Schrödinger equation. Mercury is especially difficult because you have strong relativity effects. You can no longer solve just the Schrödinger equation. You have to go to the Dirac equation, which is a factor of 4 to 30 times more expensive and more complicated.
Tell us again, though, the relativity, the relativistic impacts. Most people won't know what you're talking about.
So the relativistic effect comes first of all from the so-called mass velocity effect. You have this moving electron, and the faster it moves, the more its mass increases, and the relativistic kinetic energy goes down. So we all know from this that the bond, the chemical bond, is a sensitive balance between the nucleus electron attraction energy, the so-called potential energy, which is always negative, always stabilizing, and on the other hand side, the kinetic energy, which is always positive, destabilizing. So thanks to the relativistic effect, the kinetic energy goes down and the potential energy is more dominant. So for the free electron, that would be the first chemical effect. But then you have bounded electrons and additional effects come in. And in the end, and that's difficult to predict, you have to find out which effect dominates. And then you have a whole plethora of different chemical effects. Bonds become longer and weaker. We all learn in the general chemistry course, a bond, if it becomes shorter, is stronger. No, there it's the other way around. It becomes weaker.
And in comes relativistic effects the rescue.
Yeah, so
We've got limitations here, and our limitation is time, and we've run out of time. No relativistic effects here. It's just we stop. Okay, so Dieter Kramer, SMU, great to see you again after all these years, and thank you coming back on Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
And hope to see you again, and thanks to Norman Martinez, our producer.